It must be granted that if the wealth and success of the West are the product of distinctive Western evils, such as slavery and colonialism, if they amount to nothing more than stolen goods pirated from the rest of the world, then the West should atone for its crimes and pay reparations to those it has robbed. One could even argue that under such circumstances, some form of violent retaliation against an unrepentant West is both understandable and justified. The question we must face, therefore, is whether the advocates of oppression theory are right. It is impossible to deny that ethnocentrism, colonialism, and slavery are all part of the history of the West. What we have to determine, however, is whether there is anything intrinsically Western about these practices, and whether the West participation in them is the cause of its wealth and success. First, ethnocentrism. This notion that our way is the best way and that we are better than everyone else is certainly part of the legacy of Europe going all the way back to the ancient Greeks. The ancient Greeks distinguished between the civilized and the barbarians and found themselves to be the most civilized people in the world. Later, the medieval Christians drew their own distinction between the believer and the infidel. Still later, the champions of the West drew another line of demarcation, this time between the white man who was held to be superior and the yellow and brown and black men who were held to be inferior. When we look to other cultures, however, we find that there is nothing distinctively Western about ethnocentrism. It is present in abundance beyond Western shores. The Chinese, for instance, believed themselves to be the Middle Kingdom, the center of the universe. They were so convinced of this that Western visitors like the Jesuit Matteo Ricci could persuade the Chinese court to consider Western maps only when they were redrawn to place China at the center of the world. And just as the Chinese emperors considered themselves emissaries of heaven, so too the Indian kings called themselves Chakravarti Rajas, which literally means universal sovereigns. Of course, Islam resembled Christianity in believing itself in possession of the whole revealed truth, with everyone else consigned to ignorance and darkness. These arrogant proclamations may be understandable when they are made by the representatives of great civilizations, but anthropologists like Ruth Benedict show that even the world's most primitive tribes are ethnocentric. Indeed, it is frequently the case that the less developed a tribe, the more ethnocentric it is. Groups of people that can barely feed themselves, that have still not discovered the wheel, whose counting does not go above the number 2, still consider themselves the greatest, and favored by the gods, and their way of life the best way. What this research confirms is that ethnocentrism is universal, and it is not necessarily substantiated by civilizational achievement. What is distinctively Western is not ethnocentrism, but a profound and highly beneficial effort to transcend ethnocentrism. Only in the West has there been a consistent willingness to question the identification of the good with one's own way. Even the Greek philosophers, who scorned the primitivism of the barbarians, admitted that non-Greeks were capable of civilization. In his Education of Cyrus, the Greek writer Xenophon located his ideal regime not in Greece, but in Persia. Greek thinkers from Herodotus to Aristotle showed an inexhaustible interest in other cultures, and this curiosity about others, as well as a desire to learn from them, became a staple of Western civilization. Alongside ethnocentrism, the West has long entertained a fascination with the other, and even a belief in the superiority of the other. It was the West, after all, which invented the notion of the noble savage. We take this curiosity so much for granted that it surprises many to learn that other cultures historically have not shared it. The truth, however, is that throughout its history, Western civilization has gained immensely from its absorption of the ideas and inventions of other cultures. From the Muslims, the West recovered parts of its own lost Greco-Roman heritage. Muslim thinkers like Avicenna, Averroes, and Al-Farabi had a powerful impact on the philosophical debates in the West. From the Hindus, the West learned its numerical system, including the number 0 and the concept of negative numbers. The Hindus developed the system, but it was brought to Europe by the Arabs, and thus the Europeans erroneously called it Arabic numerals. Despite the misnomer, it seems evident that without Arabic numerals, the West could not have made the progress it subsequently did in mathematics and science. Equations and calculus are hard, if not impossible, to perform with Roman numerals. As Thomas Sowell Riley observes, today Roman numerals are only used for naming kings and Super Bowls. This example shows that civilizational development does not always go to the group that invents things. It frequently goes to the people who are able to take the inventions and run with them. The Chinese were responsible for inventing printing, gunpowder, and the compass. They knew all these things since the 11th century. Yet these inventions were closely held by the Chinese court, and they had a very limited impact on Chinese society. Printing, for example, was mainly used by the emperor to issue official documents. By contrast, once the West learned about these inventions, they had a convulsive, transforming impact on European society. Gunpowder revolutionized Western warfare and gave European nations the means to impose their will on other peoples. Printing made possible the Gutenberg Bible and the Reformation. It allowed the spread of literacy and created the conditions for the rise of democracy. The compass helped the West develop navigational resources to venture forth to the far corners of the world, inaugurating the new age that we call modernity. But if the West has shown itself willing and eager to learn from other cultures, this attitude has not been reciprocated until recent times by other cultures. In the Islamic Empire, for instance, a prevailing view was that Muslims have nothing to learn from other people. This attitude may strike us as the provincialism of the lowly and ignorant, but in fact it was shared by many of the most sophisticated minds of Islam. For instance, Ibn Khaldun, the preeminent Muslim historian of the Middle Ages, universal history called the Muqaddima, but shows absolutely no interest in what is going on outside Islamic civilization. God knows better what exists there. Even more striking is that in subsequent centuries, when the leading figures of the Muslim world heard about the raging debates in Europe over democracy and popular sovereignty and human rights, they ignored them. Muslims had access to political and scientific works from the West, but they never bothered to translate them into Arabic. The Renaissance, the Enlightenment, and the Scientific Revolution passed without notice in the Islamic world. This self-imposed isolation has had immense consequences both for Islam and for the West, consequences that we are living with today. The Chinese were, if anything, even more ethnocentric than the Muslims. By all accounts, China, not Europe, should have dominated the age of exploration. Early in the 15th century, the Chinese Admiral Cheng Ho inaugurated a series of voyages to Southeast Asia, India, the Persian Gulf, and the coast of Africa. The Chinese had the best astronomy, the best cartography, the best navigational skill, and the best built ships in the world. Even so, they made several voyages to other countries and then stopped. Chinese exploration came to an abrupt end around 1433, more than half a century before Columbus took his epochal voyage to the Americas. Why then did the Chinese quit? One clue is provided by a Chinese ship that arrived on the Indian shore in search of animals for the Chinese zoo. The expedition yielded a giraffe, which caused quite a sensation at the Chinese court. But no other Chinese ships came to India, presumably because the needs of the Chinese zoo were satisfied. In general, the Chinese went abroad not to learn from other people, a prospect they found impossible, but rather to demonstrate their own greatness and to find people to pay tribute to their civilization and to their emperor. Once their vanity was appeased, they decided to forego the expense of foreign travel, and they called the whole thing to a halt. Cheng Ho has been called the Chinese Columbus, but he is more accurately termed the man who could have been Columbus. Daniel Boorstin suggests that the exploits of Cheng Ho were anomalous. A more appropriate symbol of Chinese psychology is the Great Wall, built to keep the Chinese in and everyone else out. If ethnocentrism is not Western, what about colonialism? Well, colonialism is also not a unique characteristic of the West. My native country of India, for example, was ruled by the British for more than two centuries, and many of my fellow Indians are still smarting about that.